Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Proudly sponsored by Johnstone Fine Foods. Buy premium Irish dry-aged beef at johnstonebeef.com.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Welcome to another episode of Dishing It Out with me, Gary O'Hanlon.
And me, Gareth Mullins.
And coming up on today's show, we have the guy behind Hot Press, Stuart Clark. Great guy. I have a feeling he's an Evertonian, so he's going to squeeze in here between a Liverpool fan, Spurs fan, United fan. He's a big fan of the beautiful game. A genius when it comes to music. He's rattled around with lots of different cool people and a lot of people from the world of food as well, I believe. Like you, Gareth, he's been going into Pat for as long as I can remember.
No, it's Cass. I see him most Fridays because he's normally in after me. So it's not unusual for us to be sitting across from each other like we are now. But he's a real foodie.
Big time, yeah. Because really the Hot Press does the top 50 or top 100 every year as well. I think it might be just Dublin that they do. I'm not sure. But I've actually conversed with Stuart over the years on Twitter or X or whatever, but we've never met in person. So I'm really I feel like I know him, you know what I mean? But looking forward to meeting him in person. And
bit of rock and roll today.
Ah, we bit of rock and roll, yeah, finally.
Walk and roll.
There you go. Boom, boom, boom. Boom.
I'm going to retire now. Goodbye.
Don't go anywhere.
So up next is our recipe of the week. And this week, Gary, you're going with one of the most classical cuts of beef that people probably don't know what it is, so I'm sure you'll tell them. So it's a Chateaubriand.
Yeah, Chateaubriand, and I'm actually going to completely butcher it all together, which might get the boys at Johnstone Beef a little bit annoyed, or all you fancy-pantsy chefs out there, and I don't care. You know what I mean? Because I suppose classically the Chateaubriand, which is like the head of the fillet, really is something that used to always be sold in the finest of restaurants, and it's almost always paired two people. Like you would always sort of, it'd be obviously marinated, seasoned, seared, roasted, and then sliced. It would arrive to the table for two people and so on. But what I'm going to do with it actually is make a carne asada taco with it, okay?
Wow.
And a carne asada, it's a Mexican style dish that would normally, for all those that are out there that are mad into barbecuing and grilling in particular, skirt steak or flank steak is normally what you would use. And then the meat would be chopped up. So the first thing about a carne asada is the marinade. It would be lots of citric acid, in this instance, lime juice, lemon juice, lots of orange juice as well. So I, for say one head of Chateaubriand, I would have the juice of two oranges, the juice of two limes, the juice of one lemon, whisk them all together, a tiny little bit of sugar, a small bit now, and I would season the piece of meat really well with fine sea salt, and I would season it about 45 minutes before I put it anywhere near the marinade. I want it to start sucking the salt off the fine sea salt. Dredge it as well with a little bit of cracked black pepper, and then set it aside for 45 minutes. And then I would have my orange juice, lime juice, lemon juice whisked up with a little bit of vegetable oil, okay? I would have about a handful of coriander whisked into that marinade as well. And then some different spices, like Mexican-style spices, okay? Again, you can add in heat here at this stage or whatever you want, but I tend to try and go more aromatic and not have it overly spicy. You can add a little bit of like a brunoise or sliced green or red chilies in here as well, and then sit the meat into that for about 2 hours, okay? And then lift it out, and you were always grilling our asada, all right? So on the hottest part of your grill, then you want to get the Chateaubriand on, start to get it charred all the way around, and then you're going to move it to a cool zone. Now, what we mean by that is if you've got a close down, it's a green egg or a Kamado Joe or whatever you have, there'll be a cool zone as well where you can set it aside, close the lid, and try and turn the temperature down and cook it out to your own desired temperature. You know what I mean? You're probably looking at about 20 minutes on a cool zone to let it cook, or if you're just pan frying it and doing it in the oven, you don't want to use the barbecue. But really, the true way of doing this is over the grill or over the barbecue. Once it's cooked, then wrap it in foil and let it sit for about 15 minutes. And then I just take some soft taco shells or tortillas or whatever it'll be. And, you know, you can have a little spicy aioli. A pica de gallo, which is like a fresh tomato salsa, is really beautiful. It's finely chopped up tomatoes with coriander, basil, red onion, lime juice, lemon juice, olive oil, salt, white pepper. Mix it all up really, really well. Nice thick sour cream, guacamole, a little bit of spicy mayonnaise is lovely as well, and then shredded iceberg lettuce for some texture. And I basically, what I do then, if you're using a flank steak or a skirt steak, you'll almost always chop it up, okay? And the reason you chop it up is you slice it and then you dice it, simply because they're slightly tougher. Now, the marination and the citric acid, that will help break down them fibers, and it does, that's where the carne asada comes from, it does help tenderize them. But in this instance, you'll just be able to slice it and then almost layer it on to each taco. And that's it. That's a lovely way of using the Chateaubriand. That's a wee bit different to the fancy French way we probably normally would go. And
I'm gonna make that. I've never made that. I'm gonna make
it. Have you not? Yeah, carne asada is absolutely stunning. And the pico de gallo, guacamole.
Could you add a bit of chipotle into the marinade with the juice, right?
Ancho chilies, whatever you have, yeah. Like you get some ancho chilies here. There's Picado Mexicano. Like they've got an unbelievable online shop.
Yeah.
So all of those all of those Mexican style seasonings. If you go on to her website, she also has a little Mexican cookery school that goes on. I've wanted to do that cookery school so often, you know that. And now that it's back in my mind, you know, you'll go and you'll learn how to make mole and different stuff. Like she is just unbelievable. So Picado Mexicano, yeah, we must get her on now that we're saying that. Hopefully she'd come on. And go on there, buy all the proper tortilla shells and you name it, because she's importing the real Mexican seasonings that you can use for this. She'll probably be turning in her shop listening to me using Chateaubriand. So apologies, darling. I'm just doing this for the crack. You know what I mean? Like, don't be judging her, brother.
Such a nice thing to do for a dinner party, like cook a dish like that and just have it all in the middle of the table. Knock out a few margaritas, a few frozen margaritas, even if you're that way inclined.
Yeah,
nothing better. Nothing better.
What else would you be drinking around Donnamead, brother?
Exactly.
The best of year.
And wash it all down with a few bottles of Corona. Yup, Bill.
Up out of that, is right. Okay, so joining the podcast now, I've been listening to this guy mainly talk music for many, many, many years now, Stuart Clark from Hot Press. You're very welcome to dishing it out.
Thank you. I can talk rubbish about food as well.
Yes. Well, I hope so, because that's why you're here. Well, there's a really intriguing line here. Hung out in Dublin with Anthony Bourdain. May God rest his soul. Not many people get to say that.
What a great man. He was so rock and roll, very sweet. He had the stories, and I think most of them are true. We've all read Kitchen Confidential. And he was big into slatteries on Capel Street for the early house. He really got into white and black puddings. This was something he just couldn't get his head around at first. What I loved about Anthony was, with his travel series, he went to, say, Beirut. A lot of, like, you know, travel chefs, they're a bit colonial and sort of sneer and laugh at the locals.
Yeah.
But Tony just really loved them, wanted to take his cue from them and just joined in.
And you're spot on. It was one of his biggest strengths is he you could really see the love for the people everywhere he went. He respected tradition, never frowned upon it. He, like, the things that he would eat, there would never be a twist in his face or a judgmental look in his eye. He just embraced everywhere.
He was telling me he was in India and had a palpitating cobra heart. It was cut out the snake and you have to eat it while it's going badoing, badoing.
Oh, nice.
He also had a fetal duck egg in Vietnam.
Yeah, I heard of that actually.
When I went to Beirut for work, actually, I just watched his program, jotted down all the places he went to and followed him. And everyone was going, oh, Anthony sent you. I was going, well, kind of. But everything was spot on. And it was so very, very sad.
I always have these visions of him, like, is it the ortolan, the bird that you eat, like the hole you crush through?
When you have to put the cloth, the napkin over your head.
The cloth and the napkin. I'm watching him in that scene as he's eating it and the heat of the, he really brought you right into the table with him. It was amazing.
He found Iceland challenging, you know, the whale that's buried and peed on and everything. It reminds me, actually, that the worst thing I ever had, I was in the Lebanon, and it was fascinating because I got to go to a Syrian refugee camp. I talk about people with nothing. One of the best meals I've ever had, the baked Syrian spaghetti and their falafel. But the drivers who were taking us around, I was there with concern, heard I was a bit of a foodie and said, look, we'll take you to a really good Cambodian restaurant. So I thought, fantastic, that sounds really, really good. And we sort of turn up and they go through the menu. And the first thing they go is like, cow's penis. Now, obviously, that's all types of wrong, you know, yeah. anatomically. But I was going, oh, no, I'm not too sure about that. And they looked disappointed. And I think they thought, oh, lily-livered Westerners. They said, well, chicken. I said, brilliant, fantastic. I love chicken. Chicken with ant eggs. And these things popped in your mouth. Do you remember those space rocks you had?
Yeah.
It didn't really taste of anything, but it's just the sensation. But I kind of stuck to the task and left with my grace and dignity, I think, intact. Yeah. But it can be challenging.
And one of, sadly announced this week, one of Anthony's favourite bars or restaurants, the Chop House in Balls Bridge, closing this week. He had a lovely time in there with Kevin. Kevin Arundel will be a friend of ours. And Anthony, he did a show. He did a part of it from the Chop House in Balls Bridge.
And but, a very troubled soul into all of that, which you'd never tell.
Yeah.
No, I think you met him, right? Was he?
Yeah, like I think he was on. He was one of those guys that performed. Yeah. Very charismatic. Like he walked in the room, bolt upright, and the attention was just sucked away from other people. Anthony was just very tall, very imposing. And then you read the very sort of tragic end to his life. But he touched a lot of people and everybody. Normally you hear a few stories. Oh, he was a right, see you next Thursday. Yeah. But everybody loved the man.
Yeah.
And I think anyone who met him took something away from it.
God, you mentioned Kitchen Confidential. Like I remember reading that for the first time. It just blew my mind. And you know, the story about him sending in the letter to the New Yorker and whatever, like the little snapshot of it, and then nobody he was sending it to the New York Times, but nobody would look at it, and the New Yorker picked it up. And it's amazing, like
he actually left the Kitchens very young. He ran La Hatt.
Well, I was gonna say he was in his 40s before he even got anyway recognized at all.
I think he was about 40. The first time I met him was over afternoon tea in the Shelburne. And he loved that. He felt like an imposter. Even though he was cooking at a very high level in New York, and I've got his lovely Les Hal cookbook with the bleeding knife and a little sort of notification in there to me. Top man. Really enjoyed meeting him. Another person I enjoyed meeting was Alex James from Blur. And we did a weird interview. It was an hour long, and precisely the halfway mark, I changed metaphorical hats from hot press journalist to food and wine journalist. And
he's a cheese.
He had his Blue Monday blue jeans.
That's right.
And he was telling me he'd been down to Kerry to meet some, you probably know who this is actually, some really old guy, a real veteran cheesemaker. And again, everybody from abroad is very taken with our puddings. And he knew about black pudding. This was quite a few years ago. He's been on a culinary journey, obviously, since. But the idea of white pudding. So I sent him off to buy some Clonakilty.
Yeah.
Then I sent him an email saying I've discovered a better one. Derry Clark had his own white pudding for a while.
Yeah.
And I said, look, you know, with apricot, it's fantastic. And we back and forth for a while about stuff I was discovering across here. He'd come over for holidays, and especially cheese. Like I told him about the best cheese in the world, which of course is Bellingham Blue.
Okay.
From near Dundalk, a little dairy herd, 80 people.
Yeah.
He's at the market in Raheny on a Saturday. Yeah. Lovely man, big into his music. Alex was just so into cheese and still is. He's got a big farm and does all sorts of mad
what
stuff.
What is it? Why do you think so many people that are mad into food are generally mad into music as well? Do you find that?
Being curious.
Right,
if you want to hunt down music or books or paintings, you'll be curious about food. And there's such, I think, an analogy. I mean, record labels and little independent breweries are very similar. You know, do we go mainstream? Do we sell out our cred? What's the price point? Do we go in the supermarkets? It was fascinating. I was interviewing, I was talking formally to a guy from Beavertown, the brewery, a few years ago at a beer festival here. And he looked very, very familiar. And I said, we met before. He said, yeah, do you go to this festival? I was going, no. And he was talking about his love of beer. And he said something about football. Yeah, he was going to get the pouring rights at White Hart Lane. And he said, my dad's going to kill me. I said, well, why? He's a Wolves fan. Then the penny dropped. It was Logan Plant, Robert Plant's son, who looks like a sort of a Middle Eastern version of him. So I think his mom was possibly Morocco. Very good looking guy. And he was saying that the music business and the food business and the beer business are really very similar. There are sharks in the water.
Aye.
But that thing of cred, it's huge and all those kind of different things.
Yeah, for sure. And so it was music or radio or hot press or all of the above that brought you to Ireland?
It was pirate radio. Your country had no broadcasting laws. And I'd been on Radio Caroline and The Voice of Peace. We'll talk about that in a foodie context, the offshore pirate boats. I also used to broadcast from fields in Kent and tower blocks in London. And I got fed up being chased by the post office and the police. I got arrested at 15.
What music were you putting out?
In the late 70s, it was punk.
Right, okay.
Because that, I mean, I loved Bowie. That was my first artist that belonged to me. Yeah. Then it was pretty rubbish for about 5 years. And then The Clash came along, The Pistols. Yeah. And I was 14 years old, running around London, squeezing into these gigs, often through back doors and windows and stuff, because the band would let you in. You weren't old enough to go to the front door. And Joe Strummer once opened a fire door for me that I wouldn't see him. Me and about 10 other kids to get into a gig in about 1978. That was fantastic. So I came to Ireland, then I left, and I kept on coming back and forwards and eventually settled here. But I think my food journey began, if you want to call it that. My brother moved to Tooting when I was about seven, and it's a very Indian and Jamaican area. And we're not talking tikka masala, we're talking about dosa pancakes and regional South Indian vegetarian stuff. But you go into Indian bakeries and this lovely, fresh, fluffy naan bread with garlic and sort of coriander, and the Jamaican patties, which funnily enough are served at Crystal Palace.
No,
you go to Crystal Palace, they have the best food in the Premier League.
Isn't there there's a whole thing about food of football games in the UK?
Yeah. There's a few different Twitter accounts dedicated to it, and the pies and all sorts.
The first place I ever had a bagel, because of the Jewish connections, was White Hart Lane.
Yeah.
You couldn't get bagels in Tesco back
then. Oh, we have
then.
A Spurs fan in the building.
And it was, Lillywhite bagels with salmon and you know, Brick Lane is probably my favourite street in the whole world.
Yeah.
So you've got the old bagel bakeries at the top end. All the history's there as well. You know, you've got the marches against the fascists. Mm. You've got Jack the Ripper. You've got the biggest mosque in London. You've got about 150 Bangladeshi restaurants.
I love football ground grub, man. I love a big fish and chips and the drizzling rain, because it's always drizzling in Manchester, into McCarrie's. Me and wee Ollie sit on Busby Way, and we're just scoffing at the mushy peas and fish and chips. And I'll tell you,
getting ready to be beaten.
There is no better feeling in the world, man, getting ready for a match.
It's all part of the ceremony, isn't it?
Yeah.
That sort of thing of going to a game, the grub, the smell of the burgers and the onions, all that kind of crack. That was when I first realized that not all food tasted like my mum's.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, at least you had the luck of growing up in England, really. Because, I mean, food only started getting funky. You're chatting there about naan breads and Jamaican type dishes and all sorts. I mean, there was none of that going on around here whenever we were kids and growing up. It was all plain meat and two veg gaffs, really, like your humble takeaways and whatnot. Obviously, it's a very, very different Ireland today. You go to, you know, you're buying Bellingham Blue now at a farmer's market, and there's somebody else selling this, that, and the other. But it's you can go up along the canal on a Thursday and you can eat Venezuelan arepas like on the side of the road. It's amazing.
Hot Press moved to Capel Street about 6 years ago, and I was bored one day walking down it. I think it was 18 different nationalities.
Capel Street is unbelievable.
And food shops. There's about four or five Brazilian restaurants, Malaysian, and around the corner there's
Vietnamese.
There's a Somalian
restaurant. And it's amazing. I mean, you chat about all this rhetoric at the minute about people coming from here and there. If you want to see the brilliance and the joy about other cultures living amongst us, it's just strip it back to music and food alone, and you'll see how rich our lives are because
Have you seen the music scene change a lot over the years?
Yeah. Do you know, my pop psychology about Ireland changing is that swine Ray Houghton putting the ball in the English net. And you too. Because when I first came across to look at the pirate stations, you know, and scope them out, if Bagatelle were number 85 in the UK chart for a week, it was a day of national celebration. The idea you could be number one and from Ireland, or from Limerick. I mean, the Cranberries.
Yeah.
You know, and as soon as you two sort of did that, as soon as Ireland beat England, it was like all bets are off. So I think we've gone from having a bit of an inferiority complex and looking for validation on both sides, the Irish Sea and the Atlantic. We're very happy with ourselves. A band like Pitch This can do five nights and be world famous in Ireland without necessarily taking off elsewhere. Mm. If you look at the Electric Picnic, 15, 20 years ago, you wouldn't have had Irish bands on the big stages at those times who hadn't necessarily taken off abroad, like, you know, Amble, you know, the main stage.
What drives that?
I think there's a confidence and a belief, and maybe we've got a bit of a swagger and a bit of arrogance. I use we, it's the royal we, because I am kind of like almost between the two states.
Right.
when I'm in England, I'm going home to Ireland. When I'm in Ireland, I'm going home to England. The only time, and I do apologize for this, listeners, is when I watch sport. Like, I was at the England-Ireland game, and I knew what nationality I was then. But all of my sort of, like, patriotism is probably into the soccer.
Right.
When it comes to...
You're a toffee, right?
I'm a toffee through granddad and everything. So through thin and thin, I used to have a season ticket, and that was wonderful because it's so close to Dublin. You'd be up and over in half an hour. And the News of the World had 20 quid tickets. I had a friend working at the News of the World.
Right.
So Everton, I mean, Liverpool, obviously being economically challenged, it was the cheapest season ticket in the whole league apart from Wimbledon. So you're talking about, you know, 20 quid a ticket, 20 quid to fly over, a round of drinks in the local pub for a fiver because Liverpool is naughtpence halfpenny. And also a wonderful Chinatown in Liverpool, as good as the one in London. That was another big thing for me as a kid, Chinatown, going up to there and then onto the Marquee for a gig because it's just around the corner.
You had the weekend all sewn up?
All sewn up. Then I worked for a year on a radio station just inside the Italian border. So I got Italian food. And then I went to the Voice of Peace in about 1985, and it was set up in the 70s with a bit of cash from John Lennon by an Iranian Jew. And the idea was you were broadcasting from 3 miles off the Tel Aviv coast to the young people of the Middle East. And, you know, it was in English, so you were meant to be an honest bidder. We had letters from Jordan and Egypt and you name it, the Lebanon. It was fantastic. We used to come on to shore leave. We'd work about 3 weeks on, 10 days off in Tel Aviv, and they only paid us $100 a month. And they had this, like, DIY falafel stand. You paid 30 cents for your pita bread, and then you could
hold it up,
build a tower. So you realize that you put the falafel down the bottom, not the hummus, because it would just fall apart. And then you'd put your pickles and you'd tower it up. So that was great. Then I used to go to Jaffa down the coast, not just for oranges, but I'd never had couscous before. There was no couscous in England.
No.
And tagines and Yemeni food, all that kind of crack. And then I was lucky to go and spend 3 or 4 months in Egypt trying the food there. Kashari, lentils and macaroni and sauce, half a penny. I was living for 1.5p a day. Kashari for breakfast, lunch, and it was fantastic.
Perfect.
So I was very fortunate, and that was me hooked as a foodie.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Proudly sponsored by John Stone Beef. Explore delicious recipes and discover their premium selection on johnstonebeef.com.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Proudly sponsored by John Stone Beef, a tradition of Irish dry-aged beef built on 60 years of passion. Learn more at johnstonebeef.com.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
And how did the hot press gig come about then?
I was down in Limerick. The Cranberries were taking off. I sent in a couple of reviews and they had a staff job, and I was very lucky to kind of get it. I must admit, I've never been in the eye of the storm before with a band, like knowing them from, well, the first time I heard of Dolores O'Riordan was my girlfriend at the time saying, oh, you know that hairy bloke in that band, the Cranberry Sorority, you know, he's leaving. And my friend Catherine Hayes has been asked by him, can he... She find a lead singer. They fancy having a girl lead singer, making it a bit sort of different. And a girl called Dolores O'Riordan from the Gwael Skoll is going to like audition. I said, well, is she any good? And Aideen went, well, she sings great Ave Maria in the choir. But she'd been to pub gigs, but she'd never been to a rock and or roll gig. And I remember the first time I saw Dolores, it was funny. She was looking at the floor, the ceiling, you know, anything apart from the crowd. And her voice was out of tune. But every now and again, it would go in tune. And you're going, wow. And then over the next however many years, to see them go from that to the cover of the Rolling Stone, Madison Square Garden. Our lockdown project, Hot Press, was a Cranberries book with the band. And it was very raw because Dolores hadn't long been dead. But through, you know, the lads, I got to talk about her to Simon Le Bon, to Michael Stipe, who just adored her and said so many nice things.
He's a great man, him.
Just fantastic. And you know what? I mean, Oasis coming back, great, but we really wanted R.E.M., didn't we? I think.
Oh, R.E.M. are just amazing, yeah. Gaz is a good Dolores O'Riordan story he told recently on the pod, feeding her a dose of caviar.
Yeah, I was working in a hotel in Dublin, and I was 17 or 18, and I was doing nights, so I was on the overnight shift. and an order came in for caviar, and it turned out it was for the Lars Reed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was amazing.
It's interesting talking to bands because they're touring around, they haven't got family, and they're doing these long journeys on bus or flights. And one of the fixed points in the day is the pre-gig meal or the food afterwards. And it starts becoming really, really big. I don't know if you remember Alex Kapranos from Franz Ferdinand was doing food columns for The Guardian for a while. Like, he'd go to New York and find where the NYPD cops were eating donuts and hang out with them and get the stories. And he wrote this fantastic food travel book. And I've met a lot of people like that, that, you know, because the meal has become so domineering part of the day.
I often find that, especially as musicians get older, food, because when they're younger and it's rock and roll, like drink and drugs and everything is a big part of it. But then as they move along, they're trying to not to die, right? They're trying to make sure that their health is super important. So they bring chefs, and I mean, I've worked with loads of musicians, chefs, and it's always down to the ingredients. They want to eat really well-chosen ingredients, really simply. I think a lot of them as well want food to feel a little bit homely because they're never at home.
Well, that's
so
true.
That's why a lot of them bring a chef with them, and they'll cook in a certain style. And I often think that's super interesting.
Quite a few musicians get into beer. They like drinking it, but also having their own. And Rick Nielsen from Cheap Trick, I think, was one of the first to open his own brewery, though he's teetotal now because of that rock and roll lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah.
But I always remember, it was interesting, a little sort of Irish story. Joe Elliott from Def Leppard was quite miffed when Bruce Dickinson sent him a crate of Trooper beer, Iron Maiden. So he was a bit of a regular at Lily's Bordello. And of course, they had the Porterhouse. It's now been taken over by Conor McGregor. So one of the guys at the Porterhouse said, Joe, let's do a Joe Elliot Def Leppard beer, and we'll call it Louder. It'll go all the way up to 11% proof.
yeah.
And Joe was sending like crates of that back to Bruce Dickinson then. Oh, yeah. And I used to do a bit of quality control. Being 11% barley wine, that was tough going.
I just did his daughter's wedding. His daughter's.
Oh.
Yeah. Married Ronnie Wood's son.
Yeah.
Rolling from Rolling Stones, yeah. Tag. Good guy. Bit of a rock and roll couple there to get together, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Def Leppard and Rolling Stones.
And when did your love of, which I only found out a couple of weeks ago, that you have a love for microbreweries and beer, and you actually introduced me to something that he knew about and never told me because I asked him earlier on, this shop around the corner that sells all this.
Craft Central.
As soon as I finished that interview last week, I finished a news talk and I walked straight out. My bike was parked just outside there. And I walked into
Haven't lifted a beer in a shop in about 7 years. All my beer.
Unbelievable.
I come into Marconi House in my Pat Kenny slot every Friday with the poshest bag of cans.
Yeah. And I've never seen it before.
It's a savage shop.
I hated beer until I was about 40. I used to drink cider and Jack Daniels or whatever. And I went to Brussels and someone said, you've got to try, I think I started with a Chimay Brune. Might have had a quack beer. Carolus. And I thought, this is not the beer that I've been attempting to drink. And I just felt totally in love with it. And then, of course, you know, we had the craft explosion started about, well, I suppose, in the 80s with the Porterhouse. And it's got better and better and better. And again, it reminds me of record labels and music. There are some extraordinary beers.
I couldn't believe some of the flavors on the side of the cans. And I thought, I knew a little bit about craft beer when actually I know nothing about it after being in there.
Yeah.
The Vault City ones, I think we're talking about, they're from Edinburgh and they specialise in sours. And it's like sort of, you know, mochaccino, pecan.
It was a strawberry cheesecake beer. And
I mean, most of these companies are Irish, by the way. Like you've got some unbelievable microbreweries. Like, they're doing all these different flavours.
When is the brewing thing on? It's on soon, isn't it? On the...
This weekend.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, it's in the RDS. I mean, I'm loath to kind of pick out favourites, but some of the ones I drink regularly. Lochgill, Black Donkey, I've got the T-shirt on. Wicklow, Wolford Grey, Hope, Kinnegar, Brew, Mescal.
That's near my hometown, the Kinnegar.
Oh.
Yeah, we used to lift oysters right opposite the Kinnegar Brewery. I used to call it Rye Shore. It's all these different shores. We used to work with wild oysters. But the Kinnegar Brewery, in my opinion, is probably the first brewery to get craft beer really, really good and high-end here, I thought.
To me, they're like the 4AD of breweries that you just know whatever they release is going to be good.
Yeah.
It might not be your particular taste, but you know the beer's going to be perfectly brewed, brilliantly balanced.
Made well.
Yeah, I mean, O'Hara's, again, trailblazers.
Oh, yeah, he was brilliant. He was O'Hanlon as well, the master brewer there, actually, because the O'Hara's Red Ale, I remember the first time I tasted that, I was like, oh, that's a master technician who's got his hands on that. Brilliant, brilliant brewer.
What's lovely about Seamus is if someone's starting out and they're missing a scrimble wheel or whatever it is, a clag nut for the kit, he'll drive across because he sees it as being the high tide. You know, he wants the quality of Irish beer to be as high as possible. And rather than sort of try and grind down the opposition, he'll help them out. Yeah. And I think the whole sector, there is a camaraderie. There really is. One or two people entered it, think it was a quick buck. Yeah. And by God, it's not. No. And they've now gone. And I think, you know, you could put together a selection of Irish beers to match any country in the world. Yeah. Same with our cheeses, for instance. Yeah. You know, we're a world-class food and drink country.
For sure. But, you know, we chat about our dairy all the time, and I think you're gonna see soon enough that we'll be talking about some of these microbreweries in the same breath as we do our dairy. You know, like Rye River and some of these ones in Selbridge, we had them down at the K Club last week for a day, and I'm tasting some of these beers, and like Lochgillis, the Sligo one that you just mentioned.
Their Porter series, yeah, is outrageous.
Top drawer. But again, like it is a skill set to get consistency in a product like that time after time after time.
But there once was a time where you'd never even consider serving a beer in a restaurant. Hmm. And now, especially at Michelin level, it's not unusual for the sommelier to match a beer into a course. So I was over in a couple of years in London, and I was eating in Tom Sellers Place Restaurant Story.
Yeah.
And one of the courses in the, I think it was the second or third course in, he does this bread course. He makes a big deal out of a sourdough, and it was amazing. But they light a candle. Was I telling you about this? They light a candle at the table. And I was like, kind of wondering why they, but the candle was actually beef tallow. And then it melts down into the bottom, and then they bring the bread, and he goes, and make sure you taste the wax. And I was like, what? And he goes, it's not wax, it's beef tallow.
Yeah.
And it was a few years ago, but they served a beer with that course. And I remember, because I like beer, right? But when you go to a restaurant, for a long time, you'd nearly be afraid to ask for a glass of beer to start.
Yeah.
Where they like the very obvious aperitif is to start with a glass of champagne or a glass of bubbles. Now it's really celebrated to put, and a cheese is the other time where, yeah, it's nearly better to have a beer with it cheese. Is. Because wine sometimes is too acidic and it loses the flavour of the dairy, where if you have a really good brewed beer, it's perfect, which I think maybe people listening will be like, Jesus, I didn't think beer is celebrated in really high-end restaurants when it is.
And also cooking with it.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
You know, definitely. Obviously in a nice kind of winter warmer stew, like a brown beer is better. Fantastic.
Yeah.
But no, I think, you know, what's happened over the last 10 or 15 years, the culinary explosion has been so exhilarating. And we're getting a lot of food tourism, and that is the breweries, the distilleries, the cheesemakers, the whole thing. And it's something we can develop more. And you guys are obviously flying the flag. And we look back to the old days of Myrtle Allen, you know, at a time where there was tumbleweed when it came to food. You know, people like that deserve a big, big up for being there at the very, very start.
So you think back to the time your man at Arbutus, Declan Ryan, he got a Michelin star. And everybody, what's that mean? Like, he had a star when nobody in the country, like, they didn't even, nobody even appreciate it, you know. But yeah, like, things have moved on so much there. Hot press as well, you do a top 100 or is it top 50 every year? Is it Dublin only or is it around the country?
We do. I think this year it was 70 or 80 acts watch out for. It was never hard, but now it's, well, to fill those berths, but now it could be a top 250.
Yeah.
And at the start of the year we had Sprints, we had New Dad, you know, in the charts. Rock and roll is back. It was very singer-songwritery for a few years because we're all in lockdown. You couldn't get the band together for a rehearsal. But it's funny because every now and again someone will say to me, oh, we don't produce many chart bands. You go, well, we're the size of Greater Birmingham. How many Greater Birmingham acts broke into the American charts, the UK charts recently? It's like, oh yeah, you're probably right. Look at it. Hozier, Jazzy. Now, this was fantastic. Jazzy has been number one in the UK. And actually, she learnt she was number one in the UK, I think, taking croissants out of the oven in her local Tesco where she was working. So you still get those absolutely mad stories. And that's the glory of rock and roll and the music industry. Those kind of rags to riches things to do happen.
Is it rags to riches anymore, though? You say, like, she's getting number one hits. and you're in Tesco working. I mean, back in the day, if you were a number one artist, you really, really were counting the beans, weren't you?
Yeah. I mean, there are some people who go into bands nowadays knowing it's going to be a sideline.
Yeah.
And for, you know, for some reason, there's lots of graphic designers in bands. But they kind of know you've got to not sell records, but you've got to be out on the festival circuit.
Yeah.
That's where you're
making
money.
Of the questions I had for you today, and obviously because it's so current now, the ticket sales and the thing that went on with Oasis, and yeah. I got caught up in the Coldplay mess last year, and I got caught up in the Taylor Swift, and now I'm caught up in the Oasis piece. Like, what is the future for musicians to really make money? Is it just ticket sales and
it's all about live and merch. I saw some figure for you too, who've got a big back catalogue and have played on the radio all the time all over the world. But I think now about 85% of their earnings come from live and the merchandise. The Kronas told me many years ago that the records are a loss leader.
Wow.
It enables them to have stuff out for people to connect with to go and tour. And that's how they make money. So that's why lockdown was so disastrous for bands, even if they were like, you know, number five in the charts or whatever. I won't mention the name of the band. It wouldn't be fair. But there was an Irish band a few years ago that was sort of, you know, playing Fuji Rocks. We're getting number 18 in the charts. They were middle of the afternoon at Glastonbury and all of this kind of thing. So I was talking to one of the lads and said, oh, you must be fantastic. So, well, you know, we're not on much money. And whenever we're not touring, I have to go back and live with the folks. I said, look, if it's not a rude question, off the record, what are you earning per year? 15 grand.
Stop.
And that was for a chart band playing Glastonbury.
Jesus.
So, you know, if you're on early at Glastonbury, sometimes you're not being paid.
What will that do to the future of music, do you think?
Well, it makes it harder, but it's still probably the Rolls Royce of professions, you know, for many people. And, you know, it happens less regularly than it used to, but I was in Groningen, which is fantastic. We'll talk about the food in Groningen in a minute. Yeah. For Eurosonic, which is a European showcase festival. And someone said, go and see English Teacher. They're a band from Leeds. And for the first time in 2 or 3 years, genuinely, my jaw was on the floor. They were so good. And I came back and I was boring everybody, evangelical, and they won the Mercury Music Prize. And, you know, they are referencing X-Ray Specs and Amy Winehouse stuff from the past. They're all young kids. But their enthusiasm was no different than the Clash's enthusiasm. And when I went and saw Billie Eilish a few years ago at the Picnic, obviously, the way she disseminates her music, TikTok and whatever, is different. But the relationship, the rapport between her and the people down the front, it was Joe Strummer and me, Billie Eilish and her fans. That hasn't changed. The relationship between artists, Taylor Swift recently. I thought maybe 4 hours of Taylor Swift was a bit too much. I loved every single second of it.
You're right, okay.
She was fantastic.
She played that long.
Yeah, and you know what? The most she was off stage was for about 2 minutes for a costume change. Yeah, there was letting the backing dancers on for 15 minutes. But the one food, now we did have Chameleon for a while. When I was on Radio Caroline in the 80s, we were 15 miles off the Essex coast. Across the corridor was a Dutch radio station, Radio Monique. And of course there, oops, I'm going to have to move this. I'm drooping, hang on. They're going for a curry, it's going for rice staffel, so Indonesian food. So they'd cook the most amazing Indonesian. And that's the one food group, as far as I know, since Chameleon closing, we don't have here. So any Indonesian people, there's a gap in the market in Dublin.
Well, there you go. Yeah. That was a lovely wee restaurant, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lovely way to eat.
Well, in a nice little part of the world, Dublin, and you love, I'd say.
14 or 15 different dishes. Yeah. You know, just dive in and share and mix and match. It was wonderful.
Yeah, and it was there for a long time too. But you're probably a big fan of Sunil up in Pickle, are you? Yeah. Do you like Indian food? Yeah.
He's
world class.
I've cooked everything, I think, pretty much in that
another one. So many people have said that.
And they work, and it's my sort of go-to gift for
you
people.
You hit the nail on the head, the recipes work, you know, because I do a show called The Restaurant. I was saying to Gareth like a few months back that for all the celebrities that come on the show to be the head chef for a day, the amount of, every single season, and I'm doing the program 14 years, somebody every season brings in a recipe from Sunil. And the recipes, I'd be looking at it going, oh, she's done with that. And then I put it all together, taste it, and you're like, wow, that is pitch perfect.
The goat on toasted brioche bun is a work of art.
And we have a story about that.
We have a good story, yeah.
Do you know where I tasted it?
No.
It's a bit cannibalistic now, this story. And we didn't really realize what we were doing until we were doing it. But we were celebrating 20 years of Santola goat's cheese, probably arguably the best goat's cheese that's ever been made, in a farm in County Clare. And it's a 20-year anniversary, and Sunil comes down to cook for some of the creme de la creme of Irish chefs. We bring our families. I brought my wee boy Ollie and Cora with me, and we're sitting there eating Sunil's famous goat on toast in a goat shed.
They put a table down the centre.
They put a table right down the centre of the shed, and I think it was 8 or 9 kid goats. From the moment we sat down until we finished lunch, there was in the half an hour I sat, there was 8 or 9 born. But there was
a really cool photograph.
There must have been 20
daughter holding like a brand new goat. Dad, what's this? We're
all having little kid goats as we were sitting there having lunch. It was mental.
I still feel there's snobbery against Indian restaurants. Like, I know it's to do with manning levels and all that kind of stuff, and you know, staff, but you know, Sunil should have a Michelin star.
Oh God, yeah.
He's a genius.
He was in Ananda, he should have had a star.
I was very privileged one night. I was there after hours. Drink wasn't being served though. And he got his pickles out. Not being euphemistic. He got the big jars of pickles, some of which he brought across when he first came over that his mum had made. And I thought, a pickle's a pickle. Yeah, the pickle's not a pickle.
No.
Pickle is something which is, it's like we're into wine or brandy, that the depth of flavour and the sort of complexity is just incredible. Oh, so that was nice. So I have a lot of time for his pickles.
Yeah, we would have these masterclasses dotted a few times a year. Over the years, you know, like maybe La Rousse Foods, they have a beautiful little kitchen, like it's an educational space for head chefs, executive chefs or whatnot. But Sunil did a day out there, maybe 10, 12 years ago, and it lives long in the memory, you know, where he's just standing there. And like, he's a real blasé way of cooking as well. It's just like fucking effortless, and we're just sitting there, and he's like roasting all these spices, and you're tasting the stuff, and you're like, sweet Jesus,
what have I been doing?
Yeah, what have I been doing? Is right.
Because I think we sort of pretty much know, well, most of the really good Irish chefs, you know, the names sort of come through along with the restaurant. But I go into cheap and cheerful places like the Korean on Cable Street, Helan. The quality of the food, you know, it's comparable with top-end restaurants. One, it's really cheap and good value for money and huge portions, but you never kind of get to know who's actually making it. The quality with Asian restaurants, there's a load of Brazilian restaurants, and into the Brazilian pastels, you know, the deep fried pastry pockets with mozzarella and spicy beef. It's good eating.
What do you call them? It's like wee empanadas almost.
And again, I live in Rohini, and there's a wonderful market on a Saturday, and there's a Brazilian.
Where is that in St. Anne's?
St. Anne's Park. Yeah, pretty much where the gigs are.
Down at the stables, is it down there?
The Red Rack there. Yeah. And there's a Brazilian place doing the pastels, which are wonderful. And you've got the Hare Krishnas doing some of the best vegetarian food, Indian vegetarian food. So everywhere you go nowadays, there's fantastic stuff.
Is. Yeah, you can eat well, like all around the city. And like COVID as well sort of brought out the food truck culture a wee bit better. Still think it is a long, long way to go to be anywhere similar to England or especially America. You know what I mean? We don't really have the weller for tons of it, but you'll see different ones dotted here and there and kind of touristy spots around the country. But you can eat some cracking gear now in these farmers markets or in these little parks at a weekend or when you're on your travels. So what about you cooking then, Stuart? Do you like to dabble? You just said that you got through the pickle book.
I'm useless at any domestic task apart from cooking. My girlfriend doesn't like to cook, so that's fine. We do a trade. She does everything else. I do the cooking 7 days a week. And I do pretty much every night. Occasionally, I go to Marks and Sparks, you know, get some Saka. But I cook from scratch. And the worse a day I've had, the more I'll cut a more complex food. I find it really escapist. Yeah. I'm in a foul mood after chopping stuff up. You know, an hour and a half later, I'm not.
And what's your go-to? Like, is it always kind of aromatic, spicy, or
it tends to be
the Ireland and England come out of your meat and veg? Or
too much garlic is never enough,
right?
I mean, I'm putting like 16, 17 cloves in. I don't care anymore. I'm immune to it. I go through phases. Greek at the moment. I don't know. I just like trying to perfect my moussaka. I try different sort of combinations. I like all that kind of gear, like halloumi and everything, Middle Eastern as well. That goes back to my time.
Well, Middle Eastern food is just so, it's very aromatic. It's very depth of flavor. It's incredibly flavorsome, you know what I mean? As opposed to like Asian spices and heat and stuff like that. I find that Middle Eastern cuisine, you're obviously a fan of Ottolenghi then, if you
go
over to his place, he's a
genius. And I adore the cedar tree. the Mets say is still the best in the country. I probably am a bit heavy on the cinnamon as well. Yeah, so most of my dishes are a bit cinnamony and a bit garlicky. I do a lot of curries. Mexican, proper Mexican.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I knew what Tex was like from going to... but I got a phone call one day from my friend Emma, who worked for a record company, saying, Stuart, can I take you out for dinner on Friday? I said, oh, lovely, it'd be nice. Mexican. I said, lovely. Shall I meet you out? And I forget what the restaurant was we usually went to. No, no, it's in Mexico City. And I said, well, what do you mean? We're flying you over to see Bon Jovi. And we'll go over. This was where there was money in the music business.
Yeah.
I got taken over to Cuba by the Manic Street Preachers, and that happened. I thought it was like it was going to happen every single day, you know, my job. But I went to Mexico City and we're there for about 36 hours. And the amount of food I ate was obscene.
Oh, wow.
I was up at about 5:30 and every bit of street food I'd stop and eat. I mean, I was just like, oh, God, oh, look at that corn on the cob. It's dipped in something I've never tried before. And Mexico is not meant to be, Mexico City is not meant to be the best place for Mexican food. But by God, the one thing is when they say it's medium hot, it's like, take me to the Burns department. God, they obviously grow up. Yeah. You know,
we talked on last week's show actually about Picado Mexicana, you know, like it's a website, like Lily is, she has a little Mexican cookery school. You can do classes. Yeah, I was going to say, you probably know her, you know, but jumping on and her website, like for all that, you know, was Ancho Chili's that made me think of her, and you want to be making this and the other, but she has all the authentic ingredients, the proper gear for the cooking, you know what I mean? And I often see her, like she used to, not so much now, I mean, none of us use Twitter near as much as we used to, but she used to sneer. I was chatting about making a carne asada last week, and I just said, if she was listening to that, she'd just be like, oh my God.
Mexican food has got really good in Ireland. And I'm going to be like snobby again, but I don't really want my Mexican food cooked by someone from Drimna. I want it cooked by someone from Mexico City. And because of the whole, you know, I think we don't have that many live Mexicans in Ireland. Yeah. We now have a few. Now, look, some extraordinarily good food is made by non-nationals, but I'm a bit of a snob like that. I like to look in the kitchen and see the person from that country.
And South American chefs, because, you know, in America, lots of the line workers will be South American, whether it's Colombian, Guatemalan, Brazilian. They are the best cooks I have ever worked with. They've no interest in veering left or right of center on a recipe. They're the hardest working. I mean, the Irish are really well known for being hard workers, but the South Americans have put you to shame. But man, they are Rolls Royce cooks. They're brilliant, you know.
You mentioned arepas. I was in Spain for a festival recently, and Venezuelan food is massive. That's another gap in the market. Those corn arepas are very, very tasty.
Oh, arepas are
good soakage after a few gallons of craft beer.
You said it. So I don't know where this man's going to go on Last Supper.
Before you do, there was another point that just sparked my interest that Ed, legalizing drugs, and apparently you have a little bit of an advocate of that. Where has that come from, or what's that?
Well, I just look at the harms that are caused, and I can't see that criminalizing anybody for a health issue. We don't say you've got cancer, you're going to jail for 3 years, or giving a 16-year-old kid with a fiver's worth of cannabis a criminal record so they can't travel the world, they can't be a social worker, they can't join the guards. I mean, we had Leo Varadkar admitting in Hot Press he smoked cannabis, but he became the Taoiseach. But, you know, rightly, he shouldn't have been allowed out of the country or not to go to the White House. And I can't see any situation, if your child has an addiction, that criminalizes them makes sense. Now, I'm a bit of a mix and match. I think we legalize some substances, we decriminalize others. And I mean, let's be honest, anybody who says, oh, you know, people who take drugs, who drinks, is a thundering hypocrite. Yeah, it's just we have one that happens to be legalized. And I've done a lot of work around it, and I've met a lot of people with addiction issues. I do not use the J word, it's as bad as the N word. Yeah. And they're all human beings, they've got stories. And I get angry because many of them have mental health issues. You cannot access mental health for 10 months, a year in this country, unless you pay for it. And they're self-medicating. But, you know, would you, if your child had a heroin addiction, would you rather they're somewhere safe, not being busted by the police, or down an alleyway strewn with feces, injecting behind a wheelie bin? And anyone who says, I take the laneway, well, you know, it's a no-brainer. Germany are about to legalize cannabis. I think that's going to open the floodgates. How can a country that big with so many common borders legalize without those other countries following suit? But we just keep doing the same thing here. expecting a different result. Mm. We'll get tough on the criminals. Oh, you know, the Minister for Drugs we have at the moment is spouting the same old rhetoric that was being spouted 50 years ago. It ain't going to work. So let's rethink things.
We had Philly McMahon on the pod a couple of seasons ago, and he spoke with similar passion, and he grew up with his brother was a...
His brother died of
overdose. And it was the same kind of thing. And I do think it's a conversation that's important and worth having, because there's so much misinformation around it.
We have one of the highest drug fatality rates in the world. I was in Portugal recently with a retired assistant Garda commissioner looking at their decriminalisation model. And they've reduced drug deaths in a country twice the size of Ireland to about 20 or 30 a year. We've got something like 700.
Wow.
I mean, you know, the research is there. This is not me being a hippie journalist saying...
It's so taboo.
It is. The big thing is, it's not a vote winner. It's actually a potential vote loser.
Yeah.
I'd thought after the referenda that maybe the social sort of justice
should
thing...
Should be people before politics, though. You know, some things are just more important.
Absolutely. Now, in fairness, we've got the Social Democrats, the Labour Party, and the Greens wanting to go the decrim route. There's a little bit of intelligence creeping into the discourse, but precious little now, I'm afraid, from the main parties, or indeed Sinn Féin.
Yeah, and it's the big ones that you need, you know. But that brings us on to wrap it. We do our death row supper.
I'd love to know where you're going.
Well, have you stretched your hamstrings before answering this one?
Well, I'm going for three courses.
Yes.
And a paired beer.
Lovely.
I'm going to start something really simple. Carlingford oysters.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
I'm an oyster fiend and spent a very pleasant morning being shown around there not long ago. I can shuck in seconds, I tell you what.
What are you drinking with that?
Well, I'm going to actually just have quack beer for the whole meal. It's the one, I don't know if you've been to Belgium, but like football clubs, they have, you know, a current glass and an away glass almost. But the quack one is like something from Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It sort of, you know, tapers down to a bulb, comes in a wooden handle. It's a really dark beer, full of flavour. Even sober, the best thing in the world is a doner kebab from Zaytoun. It's just...
That's the second kebab we've had. Who else gave us a kebab?
There was a kebab recently.
Yeah, and I very rarely eat kebabs before about midnight.
Yeah.
But I'll go to Zaytoun in the cold light of day without a beer on me and thoroughly enjoy it. And then I'm going to finish with an Irish cheese board.
Oh, lovely.
I upset a Frenchman recently in a posh restaurant.
Good man. I love
that's a past time of errors as well.
I've been pissing off Frenchmen for years.
By saying, I can piece together... an Irish cheese board. Everybody's going to do a French cheese board. And it looked to me like it was a bad smell. But Bellingham Blue is my favourite. The smellier, the better. There's a Pecorino I discovered recently from down Carlo Way.
Wow.
I've always been more of a Pecorino man than a Parmesan man. Controversial.
Yeah.
Crozier Blue.
Yeah, it's cracking cheese.
The greatest cheese ever made.
Delicious.
Is Crozier Blue. Cashel Blue. Same family.
Have you ever had the organic Cashel Blue?
You've said this to me, yeah.
You need to have it. Yeah,
the Crozier Blue
cheese. I've had it off a massive big wheel. Would that be organic?
Oh,
yeah, they know exactly where the milk is coming from, and it's incredible how different it is. Cashel Blue is amazing cheese as well, but the organic one, it's like creamier, there's a little bit more depth and flavour. But Crozier is amazing.
And Cullini is every bit as good as a French Camembert Brie. It's got that lovely grassy, mushroomy, and it's always perfectly ripe.
The greatest cheese that was ever made was Glebe Brehon. It was a man, God rest him, David Tiernan. He had it was an Irish style Gruyere cheese that was in Slane, outside of Slane. He died around 2012, I think it was. And
just that long ago?
Yeah, it was 2012. I was on my stag party and Ruth Higgerty rang me. It was 12 or 1 o'clock in the morning. I was in Matt the Miller's in Kilkenny and I ran out to dance. I was like, something's not right. I knew it in my gut when I saw her ringing me. And she worked as a Secretary General at Eurotox Ireland at the time. And sadly, David had died. And she knew we were very close, you know. But he had this unbelievable, I think it's Belliard cows or something they were called. They were like a Jersey cow. But anyway, the cheese was called Glebe Brehon. And it was an Irish style Gruyere. Oh, my days. It was special. It was special just on a level I could.
The only cheese I've had a problem with in my whole life, and I did have a little taster, was that Sardinian cheese with the maggots.
Oh, I've never had that. Have you tried that?
That was a bit too lively in many respects.
Oh, really? not for me either.
I also, now please, ISPCA, it was the first and last time I tried donkey, which was very tasty. But my mum gives money every Christmas to the donkey sanctuary.
Right.
So as I ate it, I could see her on my shoulder going, Stuart.
Yeah.
So I had a mouthful of that, but it was a really traditional.
Well, you never heard of mad donkey disease, to be fair.
Well, absolutely. I don't know if you do this, guys, but I'm sort of brave stroke foolhardy. If I'm in a restaurant, I'll often go, look, whatever the chef recommends. Now, perhaps they're taking the pee out of this Brit by giving them all this kind of stuff, but that's a bit of a rule of thumb for me. If I'm off the beaten track, I don't know the menu. Whatever you like, bring it, please.
Yeah, good man. It's a lovely way to be. Well, listen, Stuart, it's fabulous to have you in. We could chat grub and music with you all day, mate. That was brilliant. Thanks so much.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you, guys.
Sure.
Stuart was good crack, huh?
There's nobody that you say that he hasn't had a coffee with.
Fucking bathroom, man. Good guy.
Yeah, yeah. And look, he's, as I said, I've got to know him over the years, and he's a really, really cool cat. So, do you know, and the last time I seen him, I know we spoke about it, but he's mad into the craft beer thing. Eh?
Yeah.
So he introduced me to all these. There's a shop around the corner from Marconi House that sells these unbelievable craft beers.
Well, if you go to Craft Central, like, it's a little newsagent around the corner from Drury
Street. Do you know about that?
Dude, I've been buying off them since nobody knew who they were. I'm buying beer off them since that shop was there. I've been doing the Anton Savage show when Anton was still at Today FM and whatever. I don't even know how many years ago I've been buying it, but the online presence is called Craft Central, and they'll have beers that nobody has. Now, the only beer they don't have that I want is Sam Adams. Super Value used to bring it in. Tesco used to bring it in, and Boston. They've all stopped importing it, and I would have thought Craft Central might have taken it on board.
Super Value don't have it, do they?
No, they used to have it. Yeah. Super Value always had it. A brilliant beer.
There you go. So then we move into our culinary conundrums. Ed, did we get any this week?
We certainly did. They're flowing in, and keep them coming, please. food@goloudnow.com. Let's go. Dear Gary and Gareth, I'm going vegetarian for the month of October. Vegtober, I'm calling it. That needs work anyway for a start. But I find it hard to get some depth of flavor as I do with meat dishes. What are some key ingredients or techniques to build rich flavors in vegetarian cooking? Loving the pod, Harry Joyce in Dublin.
I know what Gary's going to say here. No chicken stock cube.
Actually, I don't frown upon vegetarians the way I used to. Maybe vegans though, but no. The key thing when it comes to anything is caramelization, fire, and roasting are your friends when it comes to getting flavor. For example, peppers. If you're looking at peppers and you're lucky enough to have a gas cooker, turn on the flame, put the pepper literally right on the gas ring, burn it black, burn them completely, let every ounce of it is burned to a cinder, then into a bowl, cover it with cling film. After about a half an hour, you'll be able to just slipe off the burnt chard and you'll unveil the brightest red flesh. And then you put that into a little marinade with garlic and olive oil and oregano and whatnot. Leave it for 3 or 4 days and you'll have the nicest marinated peppers that you can put on like a beautiful sandwich, like some focaccia with goat's cheese and olives and tapenade and whatnot. It'll give you a gorgeous sandwich. You can slice them to finish in a pan pasta dish, no problem. Then another example would be celery act. Like if you're, you can salt bake any root vegetable, a really nice way of incorporating flavor. If you just Google like a salt crust, it's the simplest thing in the world to make. And you're basically just encasing the cleaned and peeled vegetable in a salt crust, and you're going to bake it in the oven in its own little salt chamber. Or slicing it, putting it on a pan, getting it hot, getting some oil in there, seasoning it before you cook. And again, just like a piece of meat, a piece of vegetables or whatever it may be, or fruit, they need seasoning as well. Just treat it as if you ever ate chicken or poultry or meat or what have you, you're almost always would have seasoned your meat. Do the same with your vegetables. The vegetables have a high water content. They need seasoning. But caramelizing, say, the likes of the celeriac and stuff like that, adds a whole other dimension to it. And so, yeah, get color into it, whether it's fire or whether it's caramelizing and roasting and so on, and change up the textures, and you'll be on to a winner.
Great stuff. Cheers. And best luck with that, Harry. Hello, chefs. An head chef, of course. Nice. I have some American relatives visiting in a few weeks, and their only demand is that they want a proper Irish breakfast. I know this is a very general question, but I want to really push the boat out while they're here, and was wondering if you have any advice of how I can glow up my fry up. I like that. I should say I've made a start by ordering my sausages, pudding and bacon from Jack McCarthy in Cork. Yes, I would second that. Best sausages in the world. Anyway, that's just my little bit at the end. Many thanks, Charlene. So yeah, how do you glow up a fry up?
Really, how you glow up a fry up is by choosing the right pork to start with, and you're onto a winner there with Jack McCarthy. And then, look, I always make a potato rosti, which is basically like a hash brown that my kids absolutely love this, and there's probably not a weekend that doesn't go by where I don't make it. So all you do is just peel a potato, grate it really on a grater, squeeze all the, like, so put it in between your hands and squeeze out all the excess starch. Put on a medium-sized pan onto a medium heat. Let it get nice and hot. Little bit of vegetable oil. And then season your potatoes on your chopping board with a little bit of salt and pepper. And then you're going to put them into that medium heat and just leave them for a minute. What you want to do is to start to take on a little bit of a crust on the bottom of the potato. So you're basically making like a big potato cake. And then you just take an egg slice or a spatula and you just press down onto the back. So like a kid that do with a sandcastle, you're basically pushing the potato so it goes nice and flat. At that point, then, a couple of knobs of butter, just drop them in around the edge and give the pan a shake. And then, if you have the confidence, like a pancake, just use your wrist and flick it over. If that's worrying you, sit a small plate onto your pan, turn it over, and then slide it back into the pan. And the key, you can't really overcook a rosti. You can undercook them. So sometimes they look cooked, but the centre of them are still a little bit raw. So it's going to take probably, I don't know, 10 to 14 minutes to cook it on the stove on a medium heat. And you want it to go nice and crunchy and caramelised. And then that's it. I think that's one way of, so obviously you've got your sausages, your bacon, your mushrooms, your grilled tomatoes, your potato rosti. And then some people like sauces with their Irish breakfast. So, you know, I think a few condiments on the table is what really
and no beans. It up.
Jesus, no beans.
Yeah, just
man.
Making sure.
We're on the island of Ireland here. We're not in bleeding England, man. I'm sorry now.
No beans
are not for us.
Exactly.
I feel quite strongly about that.
What's the best eggs for a fry, do you think?
I'm a fried egg man myself.
Same.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, my kids like scrambled. The odd time when we're feeling a bit bougie, we'll have a bit of an old poached egg with a bit of sourdough. But Gary is shaking his head in disgust here. But no, I'm a fried egg man for a fry. And really, there's never, whenever anybody is visiting my home from overseas, I don't care what time of the day they roll in at, making a fry is proper delicious.
It's like making somebody a sandwich. It's one of the nicest things you can do for somebody is make them a
and bread wise then breakfast. You get a bit of brown soda, some toast.
Yeah, do you know, I just like white sliced bread. Like Brennan's
sourdough toast if you're lucky enough, but we don't. I buy out Benny and Co is a bakery up in Donegal. Joe and Benny, friends of mine. Anytime I go to visit Mammy, I don't buy them now. I always take them for nothing. Sorry, Joe and Benny. I grab a couple of loaves and I run out.
Ear bag, fill it up.
I don't know why. Yeah, they never take the money off me. Yeah, and I always take a few home and freeze one, but I just use the ones in the freezer then specifically for toast.
But the key is really finding your local butcher.
Yeah.
You know, we bang on all the time about being Eurotalk members and, like, you know, it's finding somewhere that's really applying craft into making their sausages, making their black and white pudding, and also dry curing their bacon if you're lucky enough that somebody is doing that. And I'll bet you there's someone doing that close to where you live.
Okay.
I know it's super convenient when you're in the supermarket to grab a pack of sausages. But, and there's nothing wrong. I mean, there's some very good quality sausages in the supermarket. But if someone's coming from overseas, get into your local butcher and...
But shout out to Jack McCarthy. Yeah, I grew up near...
Ever taste the smoked black pudding?
It's absolutely incredible.
Magic.
And the magic. Man, black pudding sausages. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Anyway, move on before I drool myself to death. Hi, Gary and Gareth. Big fan of the pod. Here's my conundrum. Oh, this is a good one. I've just started seeing an Italian lad and we've gotten to the stage where I've offered to make him dinner at mine. Uh-oh. I can honestly say I was less nervous about the leaving cert. I love the idea of making my own pasta, but I'm intimidated by the process. Do you have any advice or essential tools that could help a beginner make fresh pasta that'll pass the test and not get me dumped? Grazie, Sinead in Waterford.
Well, Sinead in Waterford, if he dumps you because you can't make good pasta, he wasn't worth having in the first place. But that aside,
it could happen. He's Italian.
Italian boys are a little bit precious. If you're not going to get
make
it right,
him a fry.
If you're not going to get it right,
get Del Mio.
I would avoid making that man pasta until such a time as you're comfortable that you can make them whatever you want.
There's a couple of kids on the scene. And then maybe then.
Rewind about 6 minutes and listen right back over how we cook a breakfast and do that for them. But feeling that, eggs are your friend when it comes to pasta. You've got to get the best eggs you can get your hands on, all right? And even if some recipes call for whole eggs, avoid like the plague. Get yourself some 00 flour. It's a pasta flour and egg yolks only. Get the most organic. Try and catch them out of the hen's arse if you can, because they need to be fresh on a level. And the pasta almost needs to look yellow to you, okay? It's going to be really, really rich. And, you know, if you want to have triceps like an Italian granny, you're going to learn very quickly. If you don't have a mixer, like a little Kenwood stand mixer or something like that there, that's going to help you make it, get used to the fact that you're going to have to grind it out because you got to work the gluten. But that aside, it could not be simpler, all right? But, you know, if you don't have a pasta roller or dryer, it's going to be difficult. You know, it's simple techniques, but I say this all the time. Simple is always simple to the person that knows what they're doing. If you handed me a plug and told me to wire it, I'd look at it like a 10 heads. I mean, that's a mundane task to most people. I wouldn't even know where to start. So I will not I categorize making fresh pasta as being easy. It's anything but easy. But once you do it a few times, you'll be grand. But egg yolks, 00 flour, get a good recipe online. And then whenever you do go to make the dish, go with a bolognese or something. Avoid carbonaras. Avoid cacio e pepes. They'll also tell you that they're the simplest things to make, and they're not. They're really not, because you're using starch water. You're using heat, emulsifications. Avoid like the plague. Get a nice good ragu or a bolognese and drop in your pasta into that.
Don't do it, Sinead.
Yeah. I'll do it, Sinead.
Do you think so?
Yeah.
I'm nervous now.
The thing is with fresh pasta is that it's tricky once you do it first. And generally what most people do, the mistake that they make when you add in the eggs and flour and you blitz it together, it looks a little bit dry. Okay. And sometimes you just need to throw in a little splash of water. Now, literally like what I was doing there, you just flick the dough with a little bit of water.
Okay.
And that'll just hydrate the dough, just that little bit. Then you let it rest. And then I think you could.
But I would go into Super Value or Dunn's or one of them. Like, there's loads of fresh pasta now. Don't make it, Sinead. Don't do it.
Honestly, don't do it. I don't think so.
And as Stevie always says on the show, dried, only because he never ever wants to make it, but he kind of has a point. Dried pasta is brilliant.
Yeah.
It really is. Dried pasta is top drawer, you know. But loads of like Dunn's and Super Value, you know.
The only time really you need to make pasta is if you're making a ravioli or a tortellini or, you know, I mean, it's nice to make tagliatelle and pappardelle and all these things. But really, if you want to make a ravioli, then you have to, you have no choice, you know. So, make it, Sinead. Go
for it. Okay, well, let us know, Sinead, how that went.
Let us know how you're going to.
And don't forget, there's always Domino's.
or a fry.
Keep the conundrums coming in. food@goaloudnow.com.
Okay, so that's another episode done and dusted. So look, as we always say now the last few weeks, if you are going to try any of the recipes, Gary gave an absolute incredible recipe today with that. I was throwing my eyes up to heaven at the start when you told me you were going out to Chateaubriand with
carne asada.
Yeah, and chopping it up. But it sounds really good, and I'm definitely going to give it a lash. And look, you can get the Chateaubriand in the roast box.
You have your fancy outdoor kitchen there now, right?
Yeah, you've seen me plug, have you?
You out there with your big fancy Kamado Joe, your deck.
Can you imagine what it's going to take?
Fucking hell, you're going to look like Lewis Hamilton the next time you come in here. Sponsors up his left arm and everything.
Like that, my new watch. Oh, what do you think of that?
Good man, guys. He's rolling in the cash, the bollocks. Everybody's forgot about me. I fucking buy me own kitchens.
So it's www.johnstonebeef.com, and it's the discount code for 10% is
JSBDO.
I literally have to count it out my fingers. It's just the initials of the two things. Anyway, give them a shout. And as always, give us an old like and a follow and share it on socials. Don't be afraid to shout out to myself, Gar Mullins, or Gary Gazashev. Ed, what's your Instagram handle?
At EdTodayFM. Yeah,
give us a shout on any of these because we can take questions that way as well. And then give us a shout soon and we'll talk to you next week.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Proudly sponsored by John Stone Fine Foods. Get premium Irish dry aged beef delivered to your home at johnstonebeef.com.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.